Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument, Blue Cross v. Cruz. Mr. Shelley.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. In its January 8th order, the Court asked the parties to address two questions. The first question is whether under Boyle there exists a conflict, a significant conflict, between the application of state law and federal policy or objectives, given the presence of the Illinois Common Fund Doctrine in this case. The Court should answer that question in the affirmative. Yes, there is a conflict. It answered that question that way in the first appeal in this case, in its brief but alternative holding.
Well, is there any even federal jurisdiction here, since this is a suit on a contract?
Yes, Your Honor, there is, because the central dispute between the parties is on an issue that's governed by federal common law.
Oh, that's a defense to a defense, right? So you sue them, they're on the contract. The defendant's response is that it's the common fund doctrine. And then your response to their response is federal law.
I don't think that's correct.
So the federal law doesn't create your cause of action.
We do believe we have a federal claim, but even if there was not a
federal claim,
the federal claim is for enforcement of federal common law.
No, but you're not trying to enforce federal common law. You're trying to collect on a contract you have.
Your Honor, the dispute between the parties, which was antecedent to the case, is over the application of the.
It's antecedent to the case. This is a contract suit. Contract is governed by state law, except you may have a federal defense. Only if the defendant, you know, interposes this defense of common fund. Then you try to knock it out with federal law. But your claim, your contract enforcement claim, is not a federal claim.
Your Honor, even if there were no federal claim, the case belongs in federal court if a substantial element of the case is governed by federal law.
That's not the law. That's not the law.
It is, Your Honor, under the Grable case.
You get into federal court on a federal defense?
Not at all.
Of course not.
Not at all.
This isn't even a defense. This is a defense to a defense.
No, Your Honor, the dispute between the parties that arose in this case involved a single issue, and that was on the reduction.
You sue them for breach of contract. They can interpose any defense they want, statute of limitations, this, that, the other. Their defense is this common fund doctrine. And then you come back in a second round and you say, no, that doesn't work. It's knocked out by federal law. But your claim is a claim for breach of contract, and that doesn't arise under federal law.
The claim is the dispute. There would be no case here. There would be no case even brought in this case unless there was a dispute between the parties. And the dispute is over the meaning.
Look, that doesn't make any difference, right? Suppose that the only defense that McVeigh had was federal law defense. Then you could say to us, well, look, we're suing for breach of contract, but the only dispute we have with the defendant is over this federal defense. Nevertheless, you couldn't use that to get into federal court.
Your Honor, the first part of the Supreme Court's decision in McVeigh would make no sense if there were no federal jurisdiction.
Supreme Court decision. What, you mean the remand or what?
No, the Supreme Court decision in Empire versus McVeigh. Empire versus McVeigh. Yes,
right.
Empire versus McVeigh, the Supreme Court decision.
Right, I'm sorry.
The first part of the decision would make no sense if the court didn't believe that if there were a significant conflict, there would be federal jurisdiction, because the entire first part of the decision focuses on Boyle and whether there was a significant conflict. Finding none.
So Section 1331 does not encompass Empire's suit.
Correct, because we couldn't show the conflict in Empire. In Empire, the case was entirely about factual issues, and the court emphasized that.
I think you're all wet, because it's not what turns out to be the key issue in a litigation. That's something you don't know at first.
You do.
We
know what the dispute between the parties in this case was about before the case was brought.
You're saying that if you know in advance of a litigation that the only thing that the parties are going to be arguing about is a federal defense, the case arises under federal law.
They don't have a federal defense. They don't want federal law at all. We're the parties here who believe the contract.
It doesn't matter. You only want it by virtue of a defense being raised by the defendant.
But again, Your Honor,
it's not part of your claim. It's just your reply to a state law defense, to a state law claim.
I believe the Supreme Court looked at it a different way, because the first part of the decision, the way the Second Circuit had looked at this issue in Empire, that the Supreme Court then affirmed in the first part of its decision, was looking at whether the issue in the case was governed by federal common law, and if it was, there would be federal jurisdiction. I believe that this court said that in the Price
v. Your claim arose under federal common law, fine. But your claim is a state contract claim.
But what the Supreme Court was saying in the first part of its decision is that if the dispute between the parties is not factual in nature but focuses on an issue...
Well, you're all wet again. Because, look, you could sue under state law. There could be a federal defense. There could be some buried federal issue. And that could be the only thing the parties were arguing over. Nevertheless, it wouldn't be a claim arising under federal law.
As the plaintiff in this case...
Anyway, forget it. So we're not going to make any progress on that. So you can discuss your other issues.
Sure. On the two issues the court asked us to address on the conflict, in our briefs we show three different conflicts. One is on the face of the plan terms. As this court said in its earlier decision, it outlined...
The earlier decision, you know, was superseded by Empire. Right. So I think you can forget
this part was not. This part of the decision, the Supreme Court didn't reverse this court's decision. It simply vacated it for reconsideration.
But Empire, whatever Empire says supersedes whatever we said.
Correct. And what Empire said on the Boyle side of the Empire case is very consistent with what this court said on the Boyle side of the case. The court's alternative holding was that the case was governed by federal common law because of an issue that was in dispute between the parties where there was a conflict between state and federal policy.
But Empire rejected a Boyle ground for affirming the Second Circuit.
It did not. There's the very first section of argument, of discussion in the Supreme Court's decision, is addressing the Boyle argument. Clearfield Trust in the Boyle case, this would be section 3A of the court's opinion. The entire first part of it is discussing the Second Circuit's Boyle holding. At the very end, the court says, "The Court of Appeals, whose decision we review, trained on the matter of reimbursement, not as the dissent does on FIBA this would be in this S Court edition 2132. The Court of Appeals trained on the matter of reimbursement, not as the dissent does on FIBA-authorized contracts at large, so focused, the appeals court determined that Empire has not demonstrated a significant conflict between an identifiable federal policy or interest and the operation of state law.
Rejected the application of Boyle.
Next line, unless and until that showing is made, there is no cause to displace state law. But we have that conflict in this case.
What's your conflict?
There are three conflicts that we identify in our brief. The first is a straightforward conflict between the plan terms and the plan terms and the Illinois Common Fund Doctrine. The court identified this conflict earlier. It said, the plan does not include a provision for sharing fees associated with recovery. Under Illinois law, however, the Common Fund Doctrine provides that parties recovering money from a common fund are to share fees associated with recovery on a pro rata basis. The plan terms are federal policy because they reflect the choices of a federal agency, the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. That's a straightforward conflict. That did not exist in the Empire versus McVeigh case. The court emphasized that, and in fact, the Second Circuit spent almost all of its time discussing the fact that we had identified no specific state law, such as a common fund doctrine, that conflicted with any aspect of the federal plan. The whole case there was only about, did the reimbursement amount include matters that were did it include duplicate payments, or did it include matters that were related to other injuries? And the court said, that's not a legal duty. You have to show a conflict between a legal duty and federal policy. So first of all, there's that conflict between the plan terms and the Illinois Common Fund Doctrine.
And so would your view then be that that would be a significant conflict, because it's just not any old conflict, is it? It doesn't, I mean, all conflicts are not significant, but your view is that is.
That is, and there are two others. The conflict
with what do you make of what the Supreme Court said? This is what, 2137, that said the United States observed a claim for reimbursement may also involve as an issue the extent, if any, to which the reimbursement should take account of attorney's fees expended, etc. And it said the Supreme Court said it's hardly apparent why a proper federal-state balance would place such a non-statutory issue under the complete governance of federal law to be declared in a federal form.
That, I think, what the court was saying there is, first of all, no party raised an attorney's fee issue in the lower courts. The United States, in its brief, and we've attached the brief to our reply brief, stated, you know, there may be a federal issue that arises down the road. Someone may challenge something about attorney's fees. And I think what the Supreme Court was saying was, wait a minute, this tort suit has been pending long in state court. Your reimbursement claim, we're not going to let you make a federal case out of it when there's a speculative future issue that might arise.
That's your gloss. There's nothing about speculative future here.
I think Justice Ginsburg uses the word may, and that's in fact the way the U.S. put it in its brief. This issue may arise. This issue is here. The other thing to think about is that in McVeigh, there was a 3 or 4 year old state court case, tort suit, that where the settlement had been approved, and I think what was being said there was that if you've got that case ongoing, we're not going to let you into federal court on an issue that
You're reading
Empire
very, very narrowly.
I am reading it because the issue really wasn't present there.
We don't usually do that. We don't usually read the Supreme Court.
I think if you don't read it that way, it puts the first part of the Empire decision at war with the last part.
I don't see what the fuss is about here. What difference does it make whether the common fund doctrine is applied in Illinois but it's not applied in New York or so? What difference?
Well, that goes to the second conflict that we noted, and that was uniformity. There is a uniform
uniformity
rate.
Look, we're federal employees in Illinois. So you know, conceivably we could have a lawsuit. We were injured, we bring a tort suit. Then there's reimbursement. We want to deduct our attorney's fees because of, you know, the attorney generated benefits for other insureds. Do you think that makes a difference to us that we might face the common fund doctrine in the extremely unlikely event of having a common fund lawsuit? And if we were federal employees in New York, we wouldn't?
The question is whether.
What difference does that make to anybody?
The question is whether it makes a difference to the program. And this is.
Does it make a difference to the program?
Because the program was intended to be uniform across
Look, uniform for what? Uniform so that all federal employees have approximately the same benefits. That I understand. So if you have a federal employee who moves from one state to another, he gets the same federal health benefits. That I understand. But this business of your contingent liability for attorney's fees if there was a common fund suit, that is such an improbable circumstance, improbable event in one's experience with federal health benefits, then why would anyone care?
Well, the federal government cares because it costs the federal government money. It costs taxpayers money. They subsidize the program.
Also, right? Because
pardon me?
Look, they lose because a common fund attorney's fees provisions are actually for the benefit of the insureds and the financiers of the insureds.
But the federal government has weighed the balance and said, we'll allow discretionary reductions in cases.
He hasn't said that.
Pardon me?
That's in the contract. That's not a statute.
But the contract, it's OPM, the federal government, that is to select the term. By statute, must select the terms and the limitations. That is something the federal government is responsible for.
But Blue Cross Blue Shield is uniform. But there are other programs that are not uniform and have varying provisions.
But the goal was uniformity within the plan because everybody's paying the same rate. So if you have a common fund doctrine, you're subsidizing someone who doesn't, and another state is subsidizing the advantage that you're getting.
Do you think the rate is actually different?
The rate is the same? The rate is the same uniformly. The rate?
What makes you think that these insurance plans like Blue Cross vary rates across states?
They don't.
Depending on whether there's a common fund doctrine.
In the private sector?
Wherever.
Well, the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan does not vary rates. By government directive, the rate is to be uniform for every single federal employee.
All right, so how about for private employees?
Well, Well, for private employees, I think the benefits package might be entirely different.
You think it may be entirely different. Do you know anything about this?
Well, yes. I think in the Varco case...
What do you say, I think? Well, do the Blue Cross rates vary across states depending on...
They do. They're all independent companies.
Listen to me, please.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Do they vary because of differences in the common fund doctrine?
I haven't done that research.
You have no idea. So this is entirely speculative that somehow having different common fund rules in different states would result in non-uniformity.
I don't think it's speculative in the sense that it...
Yes, it is speculative because you don't know whether there are any rate differences based on differences in common fund rules. You could have found it out, but you didn't.
Your Honor, you're correct. This case was at a jurisdictional phase for several years now, and...
Well, you had plenty of time to find out a key fact bearing on your position, which is whether, in fact, variance in common fund rules leads to differences in health insurance rates.
Well, Your Honor, it would be our position. We think we could show that, but it's not in the record currently.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Shelley. Mr. Carna?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Mike Carna on behalf of the appellee. Your Honors, the Supreme Court's umpire decision directly, completely, and unambiguously addressed and resolved the common fund issue that's present in this case in favor of the appellee. In addressing the attorney's fee reduction argument raised on page 29 of the government's amicus brief, which argued the perils of applying state law, varied state laws on this issue, the umpire court stated, as Judge Posner read into the record, that it is hardly apparent why a proper federal-state balance would place such a non-statutory issue under the complete governance of federal law. It went on to state that the state court in which the personal injury suit was lodged is competent to apply federal law to the extent as relevant and would seem best positioned to determine the lawyer's part in obtaining and his or her fair share in the tort recovery. A recent Northern District of Georgia opinion construed that same language and ruled that that Georgia's common fund doctrine was not barred under FEBA or federal common law. Also dispositive of this case is Blue Cross's concession in its reply brief that not all FEBA plans are uniform on the reimbursement issue. On page 21 of our brief, we point out that some contracts under FEBA preclude offsets, others do not. If the uniformity was a concern of the government, that would have been a mandatory, mandated, specific term in each of these plan agreements. It was not. If any plan tolerates state laws, as some do, uniformity is not achieved, and therefore Congress cannot be deemed to have intended that reimbursement terms be part of its uniformity goal.
So then in your view, it's not a significant conflict that the service benefit plan allows offsetting for attorney's fees, but state law requires it because there are other situations where it's not uniform.
Correct, Your Honor. And there's no intent in the FEBA plan itself that Congress ever considered reimbursement as an issue that should be addressed by the federal courts only.
Well, you do concede, however, that Congress did say that they preferred federal courts to address most of these. You're just saying that this is an exception, that, as Judge Williams asked, it's not a big...
It wasn't a big concern for Congress. The Empire case points that out very clearly. It obviously holds that plan reimbursement claims are not federal in nature. These emanate from state court personal injury lawsuits. The recovery that Blue Cross leans against is a state court achieved recovery. Blue Cross is not involved in these recoveries at all. They sit back and wait until the recovery is achieved by the insured. In the Empire decision, the Supreme Court even makes the analogy that there's no reason that if Blue Cross took upon itself and sought to subrogate against the tortfeasor, that they would have any right to go into federal court. They then analogized and said that if there's no right for Blue Cross to do something under a subrogation lien or subrogation theory, then there's no reason that they should have a federal right to pursue a reimbursement recovery. Pervasive in the Supreme Court's umpire decision is the view that Blue Cross's reimbursement activity is not a government function worthy of federal law protections, but rather as a typical activity performed by insurance carriers in the private sector. This is confirmed by the government's concession in a brief they filed in Cruz's state court proceedings, which we attach as Exhibit 7 to our brief, where at pages 19 through 20, the government states, FEBA carriers, quote, FEBA carriers do not perform outsourced governmental tasks, are not agents of the government, and do not act on behalf of OPM. Rather, they function as independent economic entities that offer and run their own health insurance plans, performing a role that is not governmental in nature, but instead is akin to their activities as insurers in the private sector marketplace. That status was confirmed recently by the Fifth Circuit in Houston Community Hospital versus Blue Cross of Texas, where the Fifth Circuit affirmed a lower court's holding that no jurisdiction existed over a hospital's claims for recovery of medical care provided to insureds. They found that Blue Cross's role as insurer of the FEBA plan is not a government function, and that Congress delegated.
Are you talking about jurisdiction or something else? Because Supreme Court and Empire Health, it was holding there was no federal jurisdiction, right?
Correct.
So is that what you're arguing here? There's no federal jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor. We're arguing that there's no jurisdiction under the Empire holding. This is not the activity that is at issue here, Blue Cross seeking a reimbursement claim, is not a government function. The holding in Boyle, which Blue Cross heavily relies on, sets out a rule that in order for federal courts to create federal common law, there has to be a government function involved. In Boyle, the government function was the government specifying precise design of military equipment. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that federal common law could be created because the government specifications were at issue. They made that point very clear. They made the rule very narrow by giving a hypothetical stating that had the government just ordered or procured stock equipment from the contractor, there would be no federal interest to create federal common law. Well, that example that the Supreme Court gave is akin to what we have here. This is a situation where the government is not mandating that Blue Cross include a uniform reimbursement provision in any of its plans. This is a situation where the government, just like a private employer, is buying insurance, and Blue Cross is underwriting and administering that insurance plan.
What should we make of the pending state case? What do we do with that or about that?
Well, Your Honor, this court under Empire should dismiss the case and allow the state court proceeding to continue. The state court has ruled on summary judgment motions and cross motions for summary judgment has decided in favor of Cruz in that matter. And we believe that the common fund doctrine is the law of Illinois. There's no reason for this court to create federal common law to
What is the status of that case? I mean, right now.
The status of the case is that there's been a ruling on motions for summary judgment. There's been a ruling on class certification. A class has been certified. Notice has gone out, and the next step is to address the issue of whether or not the class should have summary judgment as well.
So it's proceeding.
It's proceeding. It's far in advance in its proceedings.
And so on the class certification and the effect of the ruling on the partial judgment for the partial motion for summary judgment, there it hasn't even been an opportunity yet for Blue Cross to appeal, right? Because they're waiting on that to happen in terms of the class to see if the class is covered, and then perhaps it'll be. So that there's a problem with exhaustion.
Correct, Your Honor, but there was a request for an interlocutory appeal, which was denied, and it was denied on the basis that the law in Illinois is pretty clear on the common fund issue. There's been numerous Illinois Supreme Court decisions on whether or not the fund doctrine should apply in the reimbursement setting. And dating back to 1977, when the Illinois Supreme Court decided Bear versus State Farm, the court has decided that it should that there's no exceptions to that application, that it's public policy of Illinois, and the only fair thing to do in terms of preventing plans from being unfairly compensated or unfairly benefited from a reimbursement claim without paying the cost incurred to create that common fund. And the appellate courts of Illinois have also weighed in on this in the FEBA context. The Illinois Appellate Court has ruled that the reimbursement lien by a plan should also be applied. The common fund doctrine should also be applied to a FEBA plan's reimbursement lien. And that was in the case of it was the Hillenbrand case, which I believe we cite in our brief as well. So there's a long history of Illinois law that would apply the common fund doctrine. We don't believe that there's any exhaustion of remedies issue because it's settled law in Illinois. And in addition, there's case law that says that state law does have preclusive effect without there being an exhaustion of remedies. And we cite that case in our brief, and we also cite a Seventh Circuit case which acknowledges that we should leave that issue to the state courts to decide.
Do you have any comment on the collateral estoppel issue? You discussed it very briefly in your brief, and then the reply brief mentioned it.
Whether or not the Seventh Circuit ruling would collaterally stop the state court, Your Honor?
No. No, that wasn't the issue, was it? Is that the collateral estoppel issue?
The collateral estoppel issue, I believe, that Blue Cross raised, dealt with whether or not...
You raised it. That's one of your alternative claims, isn't it? That you raised in a footnote, and then they reply to in their reply brief? No?
Well, we have arguments regarding the preclusive effect of the state court rulings.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. Given the advancement of the state court case and that there has been judgments in favor of Cruz on her common fund claim, we raised the issue that the Rooker-Feldman doctrine would apply for the same reasons.
Rooker-Feldman is different from collateral estoppel. If there's a I thought your argument in your footnote to which they replied was that a final judgment in a state court is preclusive even if it hasn't been appealed.
Or, right.
Has a chance to be appealed.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's pending appeal.
And I was alluding to that issue with Judge Williams in the case of there's the Guidish case in Illinois.
They cite a case, they cite an Illinois Supreme Court case which is that? The Bollweg case from 1986, which said that purposes of applying doctrine of collateral estoppel finality requires that the potential for appellate review must have been exhausted. So do you have any comment on that?
Yes, Your Honor. We cite an Illinois appellate decision that I believe postdates the Bollweg, which...
Yeah, the Illinois appellate court can't overrule the Illinois Supreme Court, right?
No, Your Honor, but the Seventh Circuit in 1995 in Rogers versus DiSiderio cautioned federal courts from trying to interject themselves on this issue and to allow the state courts to decide the matter. You know, here this issue presumes that, you know, there is federal jurisdiction over this reimbursement claim by Blue Cross, which we believe, you know, does not exist. But even if it did, we would state that that the court should preclude itself from hearing it because the state court has already ruled on this matter, and Guidish supports our view that there does not have to be an exhaustion of the state court rulings. And as I indicated to Judge Williams, the common fund law is very clear in Illinois and wouldn't have to. It's a foregone conclusion that it would apply and that we would get appellate affirmance. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Carr. So, Mr. Schell, your time expired, but we'll give you another couple of minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Actually, you are blocked by collateral estoppel. It's certainly the standard rule that collateral estoppel is effective without regard to appellate remedies. And what's special about the Ballway case, I think, that you rely on, is that collateral estoppel had been denied before the appeal. Then the appeal comes along. Well, of course, if collateral estoppel has been denied and then you have an appellate proceeding, then the final judgment of the appellate proceeding becomes the preclusive judgment, right? But in our case, the appellate proceeding in the state court hasn't concluded, but the other side is asking for collateral estoppel, so we can grant it, right?
I don't think so. I think Ballwig also relied on another Illinois Supreme Court case.
Look, have you looked at the restatement? You know, the proposition that you don't need appellate exhaustion for collateral estoppel or res judicata, that's very fundamental. I don't think Illinois is decided to, you know, reject what every other state said.
I think it has, and the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, has said that the question of
collateral. Ballwig doesn't, because say Ballwig is distinguishable. You didn't have a grant of collateral estoppel before the appellate proceedings were exhausted.
But what Ballwig said was that the issue of finality central to
That's
collateral
what it said, but you always have to take judicial language in context.
I would refer to the court refer the court to a previous then Illinois Supreme Court case, which I think says it as well. Ralph also cited on page 28 of our reply brief. But what the U.S. Supreme Court has said is that a federal court must look.
Yes, of course. The question is what Illinois collateral estoppel law is.
I think it's been pretty clear in the. It's been clear.
It's certainly not clear in Ballwig.
It's clear from if you combine the Illinois Supreme Court cases, they've never stated another rule that finality exists absent appellate exhaustion. It's also been followed for the most part by all of the lower courts. In Rogers, Judge Easterbrook did note a couple of aberrant cases on the res judicata issue, but not on collateral estoppel. He noted that collateral estoppel was one where the courts were uniform in Illinois. Res judicata seemed a little bit murkier because there were more distinguishing cases. So our position is that collateral estoppel is not applicable under Illinois law at this point. Two other points I'd just like to finally emphasize. One is that the uniformity objective within a plan has been recognized by almost every court of appeals that has addressed a uniformity question. The Ninth Circuit in Hayes, the Ninth Circuit in Botsford, the Fifth Circuit in Berkey.
You had multiple plans. This, of course, was Judge Kaney's question, and Mr. Corneth raised it also. If you have multiple plans, then what's the uniformity?
The purpose is within the plan, though.
Why is that important?
Because everyone is paying the same rates and everyone should have the same benefits and burdens as a result.
Of course, they have different plans, so they pay different rates.
Not within the plan, though. You're able to choose between the plans, but within the plan, an individual in one state should not be subsidizing an individual in another state. That's the goal, and Congress put it in the preemption provision, and the legislative history is pretty clear about that. And then the last point I'd like to emphasize, this isn't just another group insurance policy. And the point that the U.S. government made in the state court is on the last page of a brief. It deals with official immunity, but the other 19 pages of the U.S. court, the U.S.'s brief in the state court, plainly states that federal common law governs this case. And the U.S. the Solicitor General said
it's not like any other group life group health insurance plan.
It is
not.
Why
not? What's different about it?
It's governed by a federal statute, which the where the money goes into the Treasury.
What's the difference? Does it have different coverage or something from a
I don't the cover I wouldn't say the coverage terms are different, but it's the United it's different.
The coverage terms aren't different and the rates are the same.
Because the United States picks the terms, the United States pays for it, the money goes in and out of the Treasury, it is audited by the United States government, and we have
That was true in Empire, too.
But in a group, but in a typical insurance policy.
That was true in Empire.
And the court didn't call it a normal group insurance policy. Under a normal group insurance.
It didn't say that because it's an abnormal policy, federal law applies.
Correct, but what I'm trying to say is that Mr. Karnath is trying to make this into just another commercial operation. It's not. It's a federal program that is run by the federal government, and it was. I think it was recognized.
But the Supreme Court in Empire didn't think it was something special because it was federal.
But it did say that
if you think there's something special, why don't you tell us what's special about it instead of just repeating that it's got a federal interest?
It's special because the United States...
No. What's different about it from the health insurance that Blue Cross writes for private people, private employers?
What makes this different is the uniquely federal interest
program. No, that doesn't make it different. Those are words.
What makes it different is that...
What's the actual difference? Difference in rates, difference in coverage,
we make
difference
no profit.
In portability?
The difference is that we make no profit under this program. If we, based on the insurance, we only get a service charge that the government fixes based on our performance. Under a typical group insurance policy, the more coverage you deny, the more profit the insurance company makes. Under this program, our profit has nothing to do with that.
So what does that have to do with jurisdiction? That's an interesting deal. So you say this is cost plus. So what is that?
What it has to do with it, it means that this case meets the first prong of the Boyle test, that there's uniquely federal interest.
Abstract. The fact that it's a cost-plus contract, why does it make it important that these claims be litigated in federal court rather than state court?
Well, because in Empire, the Supreme Court indicated that if you had a conflict under Boyle and you had the first...
Why would the fact it's cost-plus rather than standard, why would that make a difference to?
Because we meet the Boyle test. The first.
No. Those are words. Why does it make a difference? Can't you be concrete and ask and tell us what? Right. What practical difference is in
that? The fact that the United States pays for this program means that there is a federal interest under Boyle. Boyle talked about government contracts for which the government has liability in the end being areas of uniquely federal interest.
What does cost plus have to do with that?
It means that the effect of this case is that the United States' costs go up or down depending on the results of the cases. That means you meet the first test.
That would be true even if you charged, even if you didn't have a cost-plus contract.
Correct, and that was the case in
so
Boyle.
So what's the difference between cost-plus and other forms of contract?
Well, both would meet the first prong of Boyle, but ours is even more significantly in tune with Boyle as a result. That's
why?
Because there's a direct correlation between the United States' costs and the results in the cases. Unlike in a group insurance policy.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Shelley and Mr. Porn.